Well, hello everyone, I'm here. Welcome to another cigar stream. It's another Dark Lord watch. We're watching an interview by Tony Blair from 2017 with his former spin doctor, Alistair Campbell. Now, I didn't want to do too many of these because we're going to have a whole summer of tone coming up. But when I watched this at like 5 in the morning, last week, I was like, when I saw it, I instantly knew that I had to cover it. So we'll be doing that in a moment. I finally got my cigar guide up earlier on. It premiered about 4 p.m. earlier on. If you're into cigars or you're looking to get into cigars, I now have a full in-depth guide on everything that you need to know in order to get into it. Obviously there's a, you know, it's a huge topic. There's more to it than what I discussed, but yes. Sadly, the Longhouse has basically eliminated my plans to make a Mario Lore channel. So instead, much like I did the cigar guide, I'm going to make 2 long Mario Lore videos instead on the main channel here on Academic Agent. And, you know, if I end up having beef with like massive Nintendo channels and so on, so be it, because the record needs setting straight and I'm the man to do it. All right, just before we get going, there is just 3 days left for the Mario Lore promo code. It will work for the next 3 days, 25% off all courses. And that's the end of the spring sale.
Super Mario Brothers 2.
Game Watch. Game Watch. Game Watch. Game Watch. Game Watch. It's a demo Game Watch. No demo Game Watch. Dale demo Game Watch. Game Watch.
Judge. Ball. Burning. ファイヤーマイクロコンピューターを使ったゲームウォッチゲームをしないときはデジタル式クォーツ時計ですゲームウォッチ
Now, if you want a reminder of why I've been, you know, so interested in Tony Blair, go back and watch my earlier videos on it. He's not simply the former Prime Minister, but remains one of the most powerful men, not only in the country, but in the entire world. Running vast swathes of Africa through the Tony Blair Institute and various other advisory gigs that he has had over the years. I also have mentioned that Blair has had a long-term project to put the woke away, so to speak, in order to make the Labour Party electable again. His classic strategy, strafe right. I've been talking about it on this channel for years now. Now it's actually happening. People think I'm some sort of mage or something. I'm not a mage. I just follow the information and share it with all of you guys. But if you don't believe me, have a look at the New Statesman. Labour's future will be conservative, says Jonathan Rutherford. Keir Starmer is cautiously ending the liberal progressive politics that has dominated Labour for 3 decades. Now he needs a true alternative. So they're starting to sound, you know, some interesting notes, let's just say, in the New Statesman. So let us have a look now at this interview. If you're not familiar with Alistair Campbell, because I haven't really talked about him that much on these streams, and I appreciate that not everybody lived through the 90s and the 2000s as I did. Many of you were born in about 2005, isn't that right? a lot of people were just kids then. You know, especially if you were in your early 20s, you will have no memory of the actual Blair era. One of the things that distinguished, or you could say characterized the Blair regime was their pretty much iron tight media discipline, their control over the media, their message discipline, their ability to use these kind of sound bites that everybody remembers. And, you know, there are a number of people who are credited with that, both during the 1997 campaign, which we're going to cover in detail on the Summer of Tone, but also during the actual government itself. One of those men was, of course, Peter Mandelson, now Lord Mandelson, who, I mean, I call Blair the Dark Lord. Peter Mandelson was actually called the Dark Lord by, like, the press and so on during that period. But the other person who was famously Blair's spin doctor was Alistair Campbell, who was, famously the Malcolm Tucker from The Thick of It was modeled after Campbell. He was seen as being a bit of a kind of thug behind the scenes. He actually himself, there's a video where he goes and watches the Thick of It movie that they made. What was it called? In the Loop or something? With Mark Kermode. So Mark Kermode and Alistair Campbell watch the film together. And, you know, Campbell just says, oh, this is a cartoon. It wasn't anything like that. You know, I don't see myself in Malcolm Tucker at all type thing. But if you've ever seen Campbell in action, you can kind of see, I mean, I think you can see the Malcolm Tucker in him. You know, I think a lot of people, you have to be careful what you say on this topic, because he is very litigious when it comes to talking about the dossier, right? But in the kind of popular imagination, a lot of people, you know, they think Campbell was the guy behind the WMD dossier. He has actually taken people to court and things for saying that. I am just reporting what has happened, essentially. So this is a interview that took place in May 2017. And it's very, very interesting for a number of reasons. Not only because it's Campbell talking to his old boss, Tone, but also because on every single one of these Blair watches that we've done, generally Blair is there with someone who's quite sycophantic towards him, someone who is a kind of... he gets a lot of softball interviews. Let's just put it that you very seldom will the journalist or the guy who's kind of on the stage with him push back in any way. But in this interview, partly because they're old mates, partly because of Campbell's kind of personality, Campbell is a little bit more combative. He kind of pushes back a little bit more on Tone. And as we'll see, you know, it kind of gets, there are some interesting moments. So we're going to watch this together, and we may get a little bit more insight into the thinking of Blair.
Do you remember the last time I interviewed you?
No. Was it very memorable?
It was 1994 on Breakfast Television, when you were running to be leader of the Labour Party. And my first question was, do you think you're tough enough for what lies ahead?
And well, I suppose I had to say yes. You could hardly say no
you
to
did.
That question.
You did say yes, yeah. But what... are you exactly the same person now as you were then?
No, you're never the same person because you learn. I think you're the same intrinsically.
Classic Tone, no tie. There you go.
Have you changed? How have you changed since 1994?
Because I've, you know, gone through 3 years of being leader of the opposition and 10 years of being prime minister, and then, you know, 10 years out in the world. So you change because you're...
And then 10 years taking over the entire world.
Learning all the time.
but you think fundamentally you're the same person?
I think I'm fundamentally the same person, yeah. Still got the same values and still got the same hopes. I'm still basically optimistic. And still very committed.
How hard has it been to go from being very popular particularly in 1997, to somewhat toxic and in some parts of the world hated?
Yeah, it's hard because it's all about coming to terms with the fact that when you're running for power, you can be all things to all people. But when you actually achieve power, you've got to make decisions. And when that happens, the process of government is your life, then you become much less popular.
But when you left, when you stopped being Prime Minister, you're the only Prime Minister ever who left the House of Commons to a standing ovation right across the piece. So actually the sort of toxicity, it's followed that as opposed to happening. I mean, I know there's a lot of that.
All right, Alistair, don't rub it in. Don't rub it in.
During that time, but it's got worse since you left.
No, the only difference is, I mean, I have had people attacking me all the way through I was being Prime Minister, and then particularly, post-2003, obviously.
Yeah, and there's a good comment in the chat there from the jolly rapscallion, which is that, I mean, basically nobody would dare ask Blair these sorts of questions in any other setting. We've seen on these Blair watches, we've seen him interviewed at the World Economic Forum. We've seen him on CNN. We've seen him on the BBC. We've seen him with Jeremy Hunt. And nobody would dare speak to Blair like this. So Campbell has got a lot of leeway here to say things that would never usually get put to Blair. And, he's not letting this go. Like, Blair gave his usual slick response, and Campbell's like, no, I'm gonna stick on this. It's kind of interesting to see what happens when he gets pushed a little bit.
The decision on Iraq, but all the way through that latter period of government. I mean, papers like the Daily Mail started around 2001. And, then after I left, when I was in office, I was still out there answering.
Right. So why did you stop doing that when you left? Was that to help Gordon?
No, but because, you're then... you're no longer in office.
But so Bill Clinton never stopped communicating, did he? And you did seem to take a strategic decision just to kind of get out of it. And then you allowed others to define who and what you are.
Yes, that was definitely a mistake. Because the truth is, if you read what I've been doing the last 10 years, you think I've just been going around the world making money, when in fact I've spent the vast bulk of my time either in the Middle East or in Africa or doing...
making lots of money. And
the things I really believe in and concentrate on. And now in this new period of my life, I'm going to rectify that.
So why did you stop being political about it?
Because I, in a sense, I felt, there was no point in me trying to participate still in British politics.
Was that a mistake?
No, I don't...
Was that about letting Gordon get on with it?
Yeah, partly, certainly. But also because... I wanted to get out. I felt the best contribution I could make was out in the world. So I started this initiative on Africa, which is, done great work and is doing great work in over 8 different African, in fact, it'll be probably soon 10 different African countries.
Remember, this was back in 2017 when he just set up the Tony Blair Institute. I'm not sure what the current number of nations in the Tone portfolio is, but it's got to be more than 10 now, right?
With teams of people on the ground, helping make big change, helping these countries develop. The foundation that I started that was around religious coexistence and tolerance is...
basically backdoor entryism into making Christianity a globalist project.
Now in 20 different countries. And even though it's been very tough in the Middle East, I've spent an enormous amount of time there. When I go back to Israel next week, it'll be my over 250th visit since leaving office. So, I had a belief that the best thing was for me to be out in the world and to do the things that I was doing. Now, the single biggest thing that comes upon you when you leave office is you lose the infrastructure. Mm. When you're prime minister or president, then the state provides the infrastructure. When you leave, you've got to build it and you've got to finance it.
But you...
I mean, I just want to stop there, right? You don't have to build infrastructure when you leave office. I mean, you could just like go and retire, play some golf, give a few lectures. I mean, you don't have to build up the infrastructure that you have when you're the prime minister when you're out of office. Just listen to what he just said. Without skipping a beat, he's like, yeah, what you have to do, why do you have to do that? Most people don't. David Cameron hasn't got a kind of massive infrastructure behind him. He just went off and, you know, had a few posh directorships and, you know, probably a free job at, you know, Gideon's newspaper and all the rest of it. Not every former prime minister, like Gordon Brown, does not have a massive infrastructure behind him. But we know that Tone does.
Do you still see yourself on that kind of level? Do you still see yourself as a sort of prime minister type figure?
No, I mean, I don't see myself like that, but I still see myself as very politically active and politically committed. I mean, I could have done what the parody of me was, which is go around the world and make money. That would have been the simple thing.
Do you accept the reputation sort of went south after you left?
Yes, I mean...
And how much of that do you think was about Iraq and how much was about money?
Both. But it was, I think, also because people didn't really know what I was actually doing.
And you just decided not to bother explaining.
I mean, just to explain what he was actually doing, he was going around the world making lots of money, but on one, you know, on those 250 trips to the Middle East that he made, you know, he was going like, advisor to the Saudis, $20 million, you know, advice in Kazakhstan, you know, $10 million deal, stuff like that. You know, Middle East peace envoy. I mean, we're not talking about just kind of, I mean, a lot of world leaders go on the kind of speech circuit and they take like corporate fees to, you know, give a 20-minute speech, 250 grand, you know, jobs are good and thank you. Blair wasn't doing that. Blair was actually getting consultancy fees from various different governments. I mean, if I was to just describe the stages of Tone, if you want, there's the period where he's the prime minister, obviously. Then there's about 10 years from about 2007 to just before this interview, just about 2 years before this interview, he had about 10 years kind of setting up his infrastructure, taking those big consultancy fees, Middle East peace envoy, doing some of the Christian faith stuff. And he had the Africa stuff separate. And then from basically 2015, 2016 onwards, he consolidated everything that he was doing into the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. And, you know, now he's kind of, you know, the tone that we follow. So that's basically the three stages of what he was doing. So, I mean, but he did make a lot of money during that 10-year period, doing those consultancies. And what the Tony Blair Institute is basically a kind of legitimate non-profit, I wouldn't call it a front, but basically it's a kind of, it's showing that all of this stuff is quote-unquote above board, so that if you want his help with something, you can go through the Institute and they get the money. It doesn't go you know, directly into his bank account or something like that. And, you know, on the books, his salary on the Tony Blair Institute is zero. He doesn't take a salary and it's non-profit. So that's how they work it now.
Well, I did explain, by the way, as much as I could. But
you didn't really.
Well, I did. But you don't have the same instruments at your command. And, you know, what I always say to people who are about to leave office is the thing you've got to understand when you leave office is you're no longer the first person in front of the microphone.
Yeah.
So you no longer shape the agenda. The agenda is shaped by others. And essentially, for example, in the Middle East, it is...
Sorry to keep on interrupting, but this is something else that we've seen as, you know, since we started tracking what Blair has several times in the past couple of years set the political agenda in the UK again. By getting in it, by using the Institute and his platform as former Prime Minister Tony Blair to make interventions And, you know, this is something you can watch in the future. When Blair makes his interventions, it's usually towards the end of the week, on the weekend, maybe on Saturday, maybe on Sunday. And then that sets the kind of story for the next week. So going into Monday, there'll be some talking point that Blair has brought up that then, you know, commands the headlines for the next few days. And he's been very good at reinserting himself into the political conversation. And now he's pretty much openly backseat driving Labour and Starmer, kind of near nakedly or openly. Anyway, I will try to not interrupt as much.
In many ways, suited the next generation to say, well, look, all the problems are really because of those guys, because actually the decisions in relation to Syria or you know, the Middle East more generally are incredibly difficult. Now, they're actually difficult for reasons that are as much to do with the Arab Spring and what happened in 2011 as anything we did, but it kind of, you got into this thing where people were saying, look, all these problems, they've all
arisen because of your decisions. Who do you think has done this post-power politics well? Be American or British or French or Jim, who's done it well?
I think Bill Clinton did it well.
So, and are you surprised that George Bush has just sort of vanished and gone off to spend time with his paint?
Well, he hasn't.
In that moment, Blair was thinking, I have done it well. I am the benchmark of how to do post-power politics. But he obviously can't say that. So he's used Clinton as a kind of cipher for himself.
Really, he's actually, I think he's done it extremely well, by the way.
Because?
Because he has immersed himself actually in, he has a foundation and a library that does excellent work, not least in Africa. He works a lot with veterans, and that has become a big part of what he does. He has chosen not to go out into the world. And, you know, what I decided to do was that I wanted to create an organization. I mean, we have 200 people employed, and, you know, it's a big organization for someone to create on their own like that. And, you know, as I say, the work we do is fantastic. So I haven't explained that properly. I think now that we're starting the new institute where we brought everything together and we're starting this new strain or new pillar of work, which is around what is the modern progressive agenda? How do we fight back against the populism left and right that distorts politics today? I think that will give me a better...
Steal all their talking points. Say, we're the conservatives now and get back in power. Isn't that right, Tone?
A voice and a more natural political voice. And that's what I will, you know, I'll spend a lot of time doing that.
And you have to keep earning loads of money to do that.
Well, you have to raise enough or make enough to be able to support it. Because, you know, if you start employing 200 people, that's a big wage bill. Mm. And you need office premises and, you know, a whole
just about
all the things that come with a big organisation.
You know, a massive organisation with lots of staff requires a constant supply of millions of pounds. Isn't that right? Of course. We have looked into some of the funding of TBI, and one of the top donors, in fact, even before TBI was a thing, for his Africa project and for the faith stuff and just in general, has been Bill Gates, or specifically the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, are always pretty much the number one backer of Blair.
About Bush, do you feel that given that on Iraq the Americans provided 95% of the kind of military contribution and we were relatively small, you seem to get more flack on Iraq than George Bush ever does?
Yes, but that's because I think the Americans take a different view. And, you know, they... I think there's a much more textured view of what is happening in the Middle East, the complexities of it, the difficulties of it, and, you know, there's at least a significant part of opinion there that would say, well, whatever the difficulties and the mistakes, we wouldn't be in a better place today if we'd left Sudan
there. Do you still believe that?
Yeah, I personally believe that. I mean,
Do you never sit down and think, oh my God, why did we do that?
No, I don't think that, but I do and have always accepted responsibility for the failures on it.
I'm not a body language expert, but if Binary Surfer was here or whatever, looking up into the census does signify, like, I remember learning the eye accessing cues for when somebody looks directly up like that. I cannot remember what they are off the top of my head, though. Something to look into.
Intelligence. You know, we were given information that turned out not to be correct.
But that wasn't the only reason why.
And for the failures of... No, well, it wasn't the only reason we went in. For the failures of planning, what I can never do, which what people want me to do, is say it would have been better if it never had happened.
Right.
Because I don't accept that. I think when you look at the Middle East today, I mean, look, I am out in the Middle East twice a month. I have a far greater knowledge than I used to have. The biggest reproach I make to myself all the time is that our knowledge of the depth of the religious, ethnic problems in the Middle East was inadequate and insufficient.
Well, that's quite a big admission, though.
It is a big admission, but I've admitted it many times. Mm. And so when people think, they think sometimes that I have no humility in relation to this, I have a huge amount of humility. The one thing I won't accept is that it's better that you leave these dictators in place, because it isn't, and what the Arab Spring shows you is it wouldn't work anyway. And the truth of the matter today in the Middle East, and that's the reason, one of the reasons I spend so much time on it, is that it's a struggle for religious tolerance and rule-based economies, and that is what the whole of the issue in the Middle East is about, and it's why we've got a massive strategic interest in supporting those modernizing elements in the Middle East, and there are many today.
But what about...
Because it will affect our own security, ultimately.
Right, but so you never sort of lie awake at night thinking, oh, God, I wish to fuck, we'd never done that.
I don't think that, but of course I go over constantly the decisions that were taken and the consequences of them, as you should do. But, you know, in the end, there's no point in me, and, you know, I always say to people, I'm really sorry if this is such a problem for you, you can't listen to anything I say, and I'm really sorry about that, deeply sorry, but I can't undo what I have done.
It's, how did you feel?
You know, we're now... This is 2017,
14 years on. How did you feel at the unveiling of the Iraq-Afghanistan memorial when you had family saying that you shouldn't be there?
This is a situation, if I hadn't been there, people would have said it was...
No, I accept that. Totally disrespectful. But how does that make you feel? That there was that amazing picture on the front of the Times of you. You sort of looked quite haunted that day.
They just take the picture.
No, I know that.
you know how it works.
No, I do. But when you hear a relative of somebody who's been killed in Iraq saying Tony Blair,
of course,
not be
I think
there,
it's very.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel sad for them and for the situation. But
how does it make it feel for you?
Yeah, but for me, it's the same. I mean, you look. You're never going to take a decision like that, where you don't have people that feel very deeply about it. And if you lost your loved one and you decided that this was done on a false basis or a basis that leads you to question the integrity.
The war in Afghanistan is still going on.
I do actually. Yes, you do.
Kosovo, you don't get it. Sierra Leone, you don't get it.
No, but we didn't take casualties in those conflicts. Mm. And
Kosovo?
I mean, there was a casualty in respect of Sierra Leone, but it's not of the same.
Right.
It's not of the same nature, and also what people feel. People have not yet come to a view about those conflicts that is, as it were, settled. Right, and some people are settled in their view that it would be better if we never gone into these places. Now, right, that's not my view, but I understand the other point of view, and if you feel
Kosovo,
that very strongly.
Kosovo worked, Sierra Leone worked, people feel that Iraq hasn't. That's the basic problem. And they feel, and I know this is nonsense, but they feel that we lied about...
Yes, but you can't...
See, this is very interesting. Campbell is just not letting Iraq go. And, I mean, we have watched so many of these. This is why this one is so interesting, because Campbell just won't take no... He knows all of Blair's tricks, so he's just not going to let him you know, give the slick answer. He's going to keep on pressing it.
You can't, if someone, you know, there have been now six different inquiries that have found that there was no deceit, there was a decision.
Mafia investigated the Mafia six times, and six times they said Mafia did nothing wrong.
You know, if people are going to carry on saying, well, it was all lies, then there's nothing you can do about that. But let me just make the point, because it's really important. The reason why it was easier in Kosovo and Sierra Leone is that you didn't have in those conflicts the interference of radical Islamist ideology which you had in Iraq and Afghanistan and have today.
Is that something that we underestimated?
Yes, of course, and that's why I say the reproach I make is not often what people reproach me for. It is that we didn't at that point understand the depth of this Islamist question, and therefore, for example...
I really struggle to understand. I really struggle to believe that between... all of the intelligence in Britain and all of the intelligence in America, they didn't understand the depth of Islamist feeling in the Middle East. I mean, I'm not really buying this from tone, I'm afraid. I've got a book there called The Persian Puzzle. It was written in 2004 by a dude from Washington. Really good book on the history of the conflict in the Middle East. It is not like Western scholars and experts do not know the Middle East. They know it extremely well. So I'm just not like buying this idea that they just didn't know what the, you know, what things were there. Britain has been involved in the Middle East for over a century. You know, some of the top Arabist scholars in the world were British. Prophets of Doom, I cover John Bagot-Glubb. John Bagot-Glubb wrote literally 20 books on Arab history. They completely understand, like, the idea that Britain, of all places, did not understand the terrain in the Middle East in, you know, the early 2000s just isn't true, I'm afraid. But this is the answer. This is the answer he's going with.
What we thought was that if you remove the dictatorship and gave people the chance to elect their government, then they would do that, and the rest is the matter of reconstructing the country. Now, by the way, the people did have their election, and they did decide that they wanted a free country.
But then we had
the interference.
Ooh, the blades are out. You know, he's serious, because the blades have come out.
Case of Iraq from Iran on the one side, and from Sunni extremism on the other, and that is what destabilized the country.
I remember at the time you used to be worried about this kind of hornet's nest argument.
Yes.
So you were worried about it. So do you accept that, as it were, we prodded the hornet's nest without really knowing what the consequences might be? And so therefore, was that still the right thing to do?
No, we underestimated the consequence of what happened when you removed the dictatorship. The only thing I say is what the Arab Spring teaches you is that all of these dictatorships were going to come under pressure and be toppled in the end, happened.
So Assad... So what are the lessons then from that to what's happening, say, now in Egypt?
I mean, if you understand what he's saying about the Arab Spring, he's basically saying, like, the lesson of the Arab Spring is if you allow democracy to happen, it'll end up in an absolute disaster. So you might as well have us bomb it and take control ourselves, because unmanaged, it's even worse. It's basically the argument he's making here, if I understand him correctly.
And in Syria.
Well, so when the Arab Spring began, what I said to people was, be very careful, because you've been through a situation in Iraq and in Afghanistan where you've removed the dictatorship, but then the problems begin. So if you can evolve a transition, do that. So my view was, in respect of Syria and in respect of Libya, it would have been better to have agreed a process of transition. Mm-hmm. So if you could have cut a deal, which I think it was possible maybe to have done with Gaddafi to get a transition, it would have been better, likewise with Assad. Now, then having said you wanted them to go, then you had to go and get them out.
Right, okay.
And the problem...
Sit down with Gaddafi. Hey, Mohammed, you're going to... His plan was to sit down with him and be like, listen, if you guys don't step aside and we're going to institute liberal democracy in Libya and in Syria, if you don't go, then you're going to get the Saddam treatment. That's basically his argument here. And then he's going to go on to say now, when that didn't work with Assad, they had to get rid of him.
The problem with what we've done in Syria is that we've insisted that he go, but not actually make him go. Mm. And the inevitability, therefore, of a civil war as a result of that was, I'm afraid, to me, very clear.
Mm. Not enough bombing. Isn't that right? He's basically saying with Assad, the problem is we just didn't, you have to make him go, more bombs necessary.
He was going to fight to stay, and then what happened was the Russians, the Iranians came in on his side and propped him up. But it, you know, there is no, I mean, what has happened in Syria is, in my view, I mean, a hideous blot on Western foreign policy. I mean, you know, this
is Obama, Cameron, et al. Have to take some responsibility.
Well, I'm not going to start allocating responsibility because I know what it's like to take these decisions. But the fact is, in Syria, and this is why I say, you know, if you had left Saddam in place in Iraq, you'd have had exactly the same problem. I mean, the Arab Spring would not have stopped at the borders of Syria. It would have gone to Iraq for sure. Mm. None of these dictators were removed in the period between 2003 and 2011. All of them were either removed or came under pressure, as in Yemen and Syria, and it would have happened in Iraq. And indeed, in my view, there is a case for saying you would have had a much worse situation, because in Syria,
Blair is literally probably one of the hardest core neocons in the world. I mean, he is just unrepentantly like, no, we needed to bomb them harder. We needed to bomb them harder. Each one of these players, we needed to just fucking go in there, bomb them harder. It's basically what he's saying.
You had essentially a Shia-backed minority keeping out a Sunni majority, and in Iraq you had a Sunni minority keeping out a Shia majority.
Okay. As you know, unlike you, I see a psychiatrist regularly for my madness. and I have
you asked for your money back.
I have two recurring dreams that I... in one of them, you and Gordon are trying to kill each other, and I have to try and resolve it. And I do have a recurring dream about soldiers being blown up, okay?
Just think of how dark this is. Alistair Campbell's nightmares. Blair and Brown fighting each other and soldiers being blown up in Iraq. Guy who... I mean, in a way, this is like what a guy with like a real conscience, a kind of a normal human being, like, you know, literally having to see a psychiatrist for the stuff that he did when he was in power. Kind of interesting to see.
Which may be about my brother having been a soldier, but it may also be about Iraq and the sort of impact that's had on me as well. Do you dream about it?
No. Lots of different things.
You don't dream about stuff that you might think, oh, that's, I'm being prodded there by Iraq.
I think about these things a lot, of course. But I also think, you know, you've got, if you're going to be prime minister of the country, and I think it's really important people understand this, your job is to take the decisions that you think are right for the country. That's your responsibility.
Pure Schmittian decisionism. Isn't that right? I'm the leader. I make the decisions. I live by my decisions. It's actually strong leadership. It genuinely is strong leadership.
And the moment you shy away from taking those decisions because you think you're going to get criticized and attacked, life may be easier, but you are failing in the principal responsibility of the leader, which is to take the decisions. And, you know, so I took a decision post 9/11 that we should be with America, that we were going to be with America, that this was important for global security. And I also took a very strong view about this extremism and how we had to deal with it. Now, I may have been wrong, but I did what I thought was right. Mm. And that's my responsibility. So I don't, as it were, agonize over having taken the decision because I know what I did was what I thought was right.
Right.
Of course, so you agonize over the consequence. That's my business and
not
your business.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's
even though I love you, I'm not. you know, you go back and get back on the couch with you.
Okay, okay. No, we just do it sitting like this. We just sit like this.
Right.
Trump.
Without a camera, maybe.
Trump. I dreamt about Trump the other night. She told me to stop playing my bagpipes. Trump makes Bush look like a sort of genius, doesn't he?
Look, I have to work with American administration, American presidents.
You don't have to.
I do, because I'm doing the Middle East.
Right.
But and it's extremely important to me. And so I'm not getting into a situation of slagging off the American president.
If you didn't know, by the way, Blair worked with Trump and specifically with Jared Kushner on the Abraham Accords. There's actually video, if you type in Jared Kushner, Tony Blair, of Kushner directly thanking Blair for his role in coming up with the process that took place there. The basic plan, the basic Blair plan on the Middle East was don't see the conflict purely in terms of Israel and Palestine. You have to speak to all of the other Arab nations too. Basically, get Israel and Saudi Arabia at the same table, make the Saudi Arabs and the Israelis more friendly. That was Blair's basic plan, basically what Trump did. So Blair was pretty involved in that. Not a lot of people know that, but it is there. If you don't believe me, search YouTube for Jared Kushner, Tony Blair, and there's footage of Kushner thanking Blair.
It's not what I've done so far in my life, and I'm not going to do it.
But you know, people are entitled to know what you think about things.
Well, I don't know that they're entitled to know.
Okay,
they're entitled
right.
to
I'm
ask.
I'm entitled to know. I don't think
you're entitled to know either.
I want to know that you can't work with Trump. You cannot work with Trump.
Look,
if Trump phoned you up now and asked you to do the job that the quartet asked you to do, for example, if Trump asked you to do that, would you do it?
No, I've made it clear, not merely have I not asked for a job, that was just one of these classic sort of male inventions.
Fake news.
Right. And I don't want that, because what I do in the Middle East, I do independently, and it's very important to me to keep my independence, because it gives me a relationship with the key players, Israelis and Arabs, because my view is that the whole way you're going to get a peace agreement today is through Israelis and Arabs working together on this, and not
so
just Israelis and Palestinians.
He comes along and says that two-state solutions are all...
Well, he hasn't said that, actually.
What's his view, then?
No, their view is actually a very traditional American view. There should be two states. And
so
the
why
Palestinian
did he say
state.
What he did say that he...
No, he said what he said in the press
in the
conference.
Campaign.
In the press conference, right. Actually. But the fact is the Americans are operating on the basis of the two-state solution.
So you don't share my sort of terror that this guy's the president of America? And that actually... The comparisons with Hitler and Stalin are not terribly overdone. That this,
I have to say, Campbell's 2017 era Trump derangements in Rome has aged terribly, and Tone's kind of sensible centrism has aged pretty well.
Very took Hitler a long time to go for the journalists and the judges. It took him about a week.
No. The comparisons with Hitler and Stalin are ridiculous.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. Yes,
okay.
They are ridiculous. However, as I said, I think openly during the campaign, I would have backed Hillary. Right.
Right.
So that's where I am. And you can assume from what I think and what I believe what my views are. But I for me, because I'm working on this issue...
So your
I will judge them on what they actually do.
Right, but your connection with the Trump administration...
Let me judge him. Judge Trump on what he actually does, not on what he says. Basically what we all said. And whose point of view is age better? Clearly Blair's.
You met Jared.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just about Middle East, or was that sort
yeah.
of just... Right, okay. And so your connection with him is that you are going to stay active in the Middle East peace process... And therefore, you want to work with him on that. But if he actually said, you know, I quite like that Tony Blair guy. He seems to know who's up to.
Well, I don't think
he might
particularly
do.
Has said Listen, that or would say that.
But do you not think it's a problem that, you know, I mean, look, we alluded to this. We got accused of lying the whole time, even though we didn't. But this guy does lie all the time.
Yeah, but Alistair, I don't want to... I've got enough issues. You know, when you meet, you've got to choose the issues you want to get into.
Right.
Right. Now, there is one of the reasons I'm doing this whole new strain of work is to push back against the rightist populism, some of which obviously was as echoes in the campaign that brought him to power.
And the government.
However, right, however, for me, I'll judge him on what actually happens. And
but do you think it's a, America,
and, you
America,
know, for me in the Middle East, I'm going to carry on working.
Okay, but America is like, we may have the so-called mother of all parliaments, which is being so useless on Brexit, but America is like the most powerful democracy in the world. And it's now, at its head, got somebody who is, you know, a liar, a misogynist, racist, sexist. That's quite tricky. And if you're in positions of leadership, I think people should sort of call that out.
Yeah, well, where there are things I profoundly disagree with, I will and have.
Right. So what's he done since he became president that you profoundly disagree with?
So, for example, when all that stuff on immigration happened, I was perfectly prepared to be critical of it. So I've not got a problem with doing that on individual issues. What I'm not going to do, because I actually think, A, let's see what really happens, mm-hmm. and B, I am engaged in something in which
okay.
I'm going to cooperate with administration.
Is there a part of you that thinks actually that Obama was not great for the Middle East and that Trump could be?
It's less the former than I think it's possible that if this administration goes down the path that I'm advocating, which is to build a strategic alliance in the Middle East whose purpose is to fight extremism, mm-hmm. whether of the Shia sort promoted by the theocracy in Iran or of the Sunni sort, I think if they decide to go down that path, that will be very productive. So whatever else is happening in the world and where you agree...
Basically, Trump could be great if he listens to me. What's his answer? and basically, as far as I can tell, he did basically follow Blair's plan in the Middle East.
You'll disagree, and whatever's happening in America, on the Middle East specifically, there is actually an opportunity. Now, look, I know because this is one of the situations you get into today where, you know, things become so polarized that if I'm with a group of Democrats in the US and I even suggest there might be an area in which the Trump administration could or you could do good, and people just go mental with you. But the reality is there is an alliance to be built in the Middle East today around the whole struggle over religious tolerance. And
this is actually interesting because Blair is genuinely being like the adult in the room here. You know, the entire left just went mental about Trump derangement syndrome. Blair actually managed to get something out of it for his own agenda.
Actually, if the Trump administration want to put themselves behind that, which they could.
But this Bannon guy basically thinks for America to reassert itself, you've got to wipe out, you've got to sort of bring China down. And on the religious front, you sort of Christians are superior to Muslims, and that's...
Well, I don't know whether he thinks that or not, but I know that Tillerson, who's the Secretary of State, Mattis, who's the Secretary of Defence, and McMaster, who's the National Security Advisor, don't think that.
Right, so we're in a position, basically, where we've got to kind of hope these guys do the right thing because we're worried Trump might do the wrong thing.
No, I think we're just in a situation of saying, let's determine the character of this administration finally by what they do.
Okay. And when he sort of started that thing about, you know, moving the embassy, and, you know, did you not think, oh my God, these people know what they're doing?
Yeah, but I just point out to you, the embassy has not,
okay.
in fact, moved.
All right, okay. Would you have had, I know you're not the Prime Minister, but were you Theresa May and you went on that first visit? I mean, did you not think that offering Trump a state visit when he's barely been elected was like an act of utter sycophancy and an insult to Her Majesty the Queen, for whom we both have enormous fondness?
No, she's perfectly entitled to get alongside the American
yeah,
president.
Yeah, that's fine, but a state visit.
Oh, come on, Alistair.
What?
Now you're sort of elevating this. I mean,
no, but
really.
Seriously, a state visit is a major diplomatic chip, and we don't have many at the moment.
Yeah,
this
okay.
is with him.
Yeah,
gold carriage with the Queen down the mall.
Yeah, I know, but
well, apparently it's going to be in Aberdeen now because nobody wants him to come here.
Look, are we talking about my prejudices or your prejudices?
I want to know what you think.
Look, what I think is,
We would not have sat down and said, right, new president, not sure about him. State visit. We wouldn't have done that.
Oh, come on.
We wouldn't.
No, Alistair, honestly. When George Bush came in, we made every effort to get alongside him straight away.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Right, so, come on.
Based on values.
Yeah, but...
Just true realpolitik of Blair. Just like, shut up, Alistair. What are you on about?
But also based on the fact he was president of the United States. Come on.
So
we thought Al Gore was going to win the election, if you remember.
Yes, I do.
Right, so...
Right.
And, by the way, there were... There were people who were horrified at the prospect.
So you would have,
George...
you would have probably gone along and given Donald Trump a state visit.
Well, I have no idea what I would offer him a state visit, but I'm not going to criticise her for getting alongside the American president. And I think she's entitled to do that.
Okay.
And in any event, it's important the British Prime Minister and the American president have a good relationship.
Okay. Do you remember our very first meeting with Vladimir Putin? Do you remember what you said after it?
Because you keep these damn diaries. You remember all these things.
I don't remember.
I mean, I remember
it,
the first time.
It.
I think the first time I met Vladimir Putin.
First time he came to Downing Street before he was president, and as he left, you said, I think he's going to be okay.
Yes.
Stand by
the judgment at the time, because actually at that point, it was very clear he wanted to point westward. I remember our first meeting in St. Petersburg, which was immensely successful.
But it's been a bit of a disaster, hasn't it?
Well, I don't...
Are you going to defend him as well now?
No, I'm not going to...
Trump's good. Putin's good.
I didn't say that.
Assad. Leave him alone. So, Putin.
So, no, of course I don't.
Bad for the world?
I think this resurgent Russian nationalism, I understand it. I understand what motivates it. I'm not sure we have always... In fact, I'm sure we haven't always made the right overtures to try and bring Russia on side with us.
And can you imagine if every politician was just as sensible as this? You know, I mean, okay, we still may come to different conclusions at the end of it, but I mean, at least this guy is trying to be rational, studying his opponents, understanding where Russian nationalism comes from. I mean, who of our current politicians speaks like this? Basically, none of them.
But I don't approve of the things they're doing in Syria or Ukraine, of course.
And what about interfering in the American elections?
Yeah, well, if they...
And the French elections and the German elections and our...
Yeah, no, I think this is... I'm completely concur with those people who think this is a big challenge for us.
And why do you think Trump doesn't sort of join in that concurrence? He seems to...
We've done the Trump business.
No, wait,
get off Trump and get back onto whatever.
All right, onto Putin.
Yeah.
But you're in...
Basically, like, stop fucking asking me about Trump.
Your institute, as you said, is in part a response to Trump politics.
Well, it is partly a response to the politics that brought him to power, politics that gave us Brexit, and also to this notion that that type of authoritarian populism that's represented by the kind of Putinist concept of leadership...
And which Trump wants to follow.
Well, I don't know whether he wants to follow that or not. I sincerely hope not. But
he does.
I don't think
he's jealous of Trump, isn't he? He's jealous of Putin. He is. He's jealous of Putin. He's got his parliament. He's got his media. You don't agree with me? You don't think he actually looks at Putin and thinks, I want to be that guy?
There was a moment where you just, Alistair, come on. He was trying the Jedi mind trick there. Fucking shut up about Trump.
I want to have that power.
I have no idea, but in any event, it's not possible in America.
No, well, let's hope not.
No, I think not for sure.
Okay.
And the real issue for Russia in the end is, can it find its way to make the reforms to its economy that can strengthen the country and give it a power that is in the end going to be
right.
going to grow because it's based, because all power ultimately, you're never going to end up with a country that's a huge power without its economy being in good shape.
Right.
I mean, why is China so much more powerful today? Because they reformed their economy.
Do you think
and
we're slightly, because we're all focusing so much on Russia at the moment, whose economy actually isn't in great shape, do you think we're slightly missing the main picture with Trump? That actually the big thing is going to be Trump's relations with China.
Oh, absolutely. The big thing is going to be Trump's relationship with China. And actually, it could be good. The American relationship with China, I think most people haven't caught up to the fact that this is the most important relationship of the 21st century, for sure.
Yeah. So Putin is a bit of a sideshow.
Well, he's not a sideshow, because I think it's very important that China itself develops and evolves in a way, politically and economically, which is not based on the Putin model.
Right. And Trump, well, I know we've done
that has gone really badly. And this is Blair just like at the end of his tether with the Trump stuff. But I mean, if you look at where they were 6 years ago talking about China, China has gone much closer to Putin, much more on Putinist lines now. She has consolidated power. So basically everything has kind of not gone in the way that Blair would have wanted it to. But then again, as I just said, most of our leaders are not sensible like this.
Trump. I know we've done Trump. Wait a minute. No,
let's do him again.
No, all right. Putin, have you read that book by that guy Pomerantsev, Nothing is True and Anything is Possible, which is about Russia? But actually this whole fake news thing and the way that Trump is kind of handling the media, it's about trying to do that. He's trying to delegitimize any source of information other than himself and his ridiculous Twitter feed, which Putin has done by kind of throwing people in jail and invading countries and saying you haven't invaded them. Blowing up planes and saying you didn't, and killing people on the streets of London and saying you haven't.
Yeah, but I think it is different in a very crucial way, actually. I mean, look, I think there's and so do you. I think there's a major problem with the way the media operates in the West.
Based.
Which is becoming polarized and partisan. And, you know, not everything Trump says about his media coverage is unfair.
Based.
Not everything, but he goes beyond anything.
Yeah, no, I agree he goes beyond it, but I think we've got to be very clear. You know, the left media finds it very hard to be objective on Trump. Now, my point is different. My point is the right-wing media is brutal towards progressive politicians. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, you've actually got a media today that is completely partisan.
Right, with the right lie more than the left in general. I think. Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph are worse than the Guardian and the Mirror.
They are far more brutal and aggressive. They are far more brutal and aggressive, but the fact is it doesn't actually help our cause to be partisan precisely for the reason you give, because in the end what happens is that they are so much more brutal at it and aggressive at it than we are. Mm. And the trouble with progressive politics always is that we are...
I mean, I don't know if Campbell did this deliberately, if he's like playing Owen Jones or something in this interview to come across like an SJW, you know, in the face of like Blair's just relentless realism. But it's working really well because it's making like Blair just look super keyed in, and it's making Campbell look like an idiot. Please bear in mind that Campbell is Blair's spin doctor and has devoted his life to making Blair look good. So this could all be an act. I wouldn't put it beyond them, but I don't actually get the impression that it is. I get the impression that Campbell may be, you know, these may be his genuine views.
Perfectly happy to turn on our own, where they basically defend their positions very strongly.
Mm. Okay. How are we going to stop this ridiculous Brexit thing?
What we've got to do is to mount an effective, coordinated campaign that has a very, very simple message at the heart of it.
Which is stop Brexit. It's not mess around with it. It's not sort of soft, hard. It's actually, this thing is wrong. It's bad for the country. Therefore, we have to do all we can to stop
it. It's at this moment to say the option of changing your mind is open to you.
Also remember, by the way, just think of the positioning. This interview, unlike all of the other Blair interviews that I watch, which have like 200 views and things like that, this interview's got like 600,000 views. And it wasn't put out by The Guardian or The New Statesman or, you know, The Times. it was put out by GQ, which is a fashion magazine, young, read by young men. So the positioning on this interview is interesting in itself. So, I mean, bear in mind, these two guys are masters of presentation and spin, right? Also bear in mind that there is another interview online, I think also with GQ, but it might not be, where Owen Jones met Alistair Campbell and the roles are reversed. So I think his Trump derangement syndrome is genuine, but I wouldn't have put it beyond them to have had a chat before this to say, listen, Alistair, dial up your kind of left-wing nuttery on this, you know, maybe, who knows. They will have certainly talked about what they were going to talk about before they had this interview, without doubt.
Right. And don't let anyone tell you it isn't. Mm. Because what the right-wing media cartel and the government are trying to do is to create a sense, not just of inevitability, but of the impropriety of even discussing what should happen when we don't yet know the terms, and when it's clear that when Theresa May said Brexit means Brexit, she actually means Brexit at any cost, in whatever circumstances. Yeah. And we now have this extraordinary situation in which we're saying we're going to become a great global trading nation, and we're going to start by withdrawing from the biggest global trading market right on our doorstep. And we're now trying to advocate for, say, much greater defence and security cooperation within Europe, which is a perfectly good thing, but somehow we should be getting closer to Europe on defence and security cooperation, and therefore, by the way, pooling our sovereignty. But when it comes to our economy, we're already 50% of our trade is with Europe, we should be doing the opposite. I mean, it literally makes no sense.
So it is madness.
I mean, I personally think Brexit is a catastrophe for Britain. I deeply believe that, but I have to accept there's been a referendum.
Right.
But I know it's really important we phrase this in the right way, because the truth of the matter is, and this is why I've used the analogy of the house swap, and it's a good analogy. The fact is, we agreed that we were going to swap our house for another house. Mm-hmm. But this other house, the dispute about it is a dispute about claims at the moment. Mm. You know, we say it's going to be ugly. Other people say it's beautiful. Mm. Okay. We're now going to get the chance to see, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to test it. We're going to see the neighborhood. We're going to do the survey. We're going to go around it. We're going to look at it and see whether it really meets our needs or not. Our case has got to be very, very simple. It is that if we come to the conclusion that the gain is very slight, the pain is enormous, and actually, thanks to the concentration on Brexit, nothing else in the country has been done properly, we are entitled to change our mind.
Correct. Right, but the 2 years, the inevitability in the 2 years, do you think we'll know? I mean, I agree with you. I think it's a catastrophe. I think it's going to be a disaster. But do you think we'll know that sufficient for people to say, yeah, this is not going to happen?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I'm not sure what the answer is.
And you can't have...
Because the risk is we only... Look, it's like the currency. The currency is, what, 15 to 20% down.
Yeah.
Now, that is not a market correction. That is a prediction by the international financial markets.
The economy's going to go tank.
Well, that we're going to be that much poorer.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's why they have
been shorting our currency. Right, and you barely hear about it.
Right. Now, so, that will have an impact on living standards, because it'll have an impact on inflation, particularly with the poorest families and so on. I don't know whether this all becomes manifest, though. Mm. But I feel it. There is a good chance that it will do. And I also think the other thing that we've got to point out to people is one of the reasons the government just says Brexit means Brexit and don't question any longer why we're doing this.
Because they're worried.
They're supremely worried that if you subject the claim that this is a good idea to analysis,
what are
you left with? You're left with EU migration,
both of them,
and the European Court of Justice. It is now absolutely clear that we want to keep the majority of these EU migrants, that we need them. So we're actually talking about stopping a very small number of people. So we're not even dealing with the immigration issue particularly. And on the European Court of Justice, I would defy most people to name a European Court of Justice decision they'd ever heard of.
Well, they think it's anyway.
And if we're going to have a free trade agreement with Europe, by the way, then we'll also have to have a disputes resolution procedure. Mm. And if that's not the European Court of Justice, it's going to be something that looks like it.
Right. Now, I know you're part of the sort of, you know, international union.
I'm very quiet here because obviously I voted Remain and have no regret. So,
you're the former presidents and prime ministers, and you don't like to criticise other members of that group. But do you not look at Theresa May and think, one, she fought Remain and now has gone hard Brexit, and two, she must know deep down that what she's doing is wrong for the future of Britain. And as a prime minister who on Iraq said, you do what you think is the right thing, do you not look at that and just sort of feel a kind of certain contempt?
No, I don't.
Or is this my prejudice again?
No, it's not your prejudice. It's your opinion. You're entitled to it. I don't criticise.
But she's doing the wrong
personally.
Thing. She's doing the wrong thing.
Of course I believe this is the wrong thing, but you know, I'm not going to subject her to personal criticism. It's not a personal criticism. She inherited a situation where she believes it's her duty to deliver Brexit. Mm.
I love it. Like, he just will not be drawn into, you know, slagging anyone off until we get to Corbyn, which is amazing.
She believes, and you know, I understand why she believes this. She thinks, and these people think, that if you reopen this debate, you're going to cause huge stresses and strains in the politics of the country.
But she's basically
By the way, I understand
driven,
that.
She's being driven by a Tory right wing.
I understand that.
But, and the Mail.
Well, the problem is, if you had a vibrant opposition, then she would come under pressure from the centre and from the left as well as from the right. The trouble is, at the moment, she's really only under pressure from the right-wing media cartel, you know, the Mail's.
Basically, Blair is saying, listen, Alistair, like, if we were fucking there, we would be wiping the floor with Theresa May and we'd hammer them in the next election. That's what Tone is thinking. And he's probably right about that. The, you know, the Labour were completely ineffectual during that whole era. This Tory government has been an absolute shambles for 13 straight years at this point. And Labour have been nowhere. They've just been nowhere. May should have lost. Boris should have lost. Fucking Cameron should have lost in 2015. They've been rubbish. But they've won. I mean, I think they've won more elections than any party in history at this point in a row. We've had what? Cameron, May, Boris, and now bloody... and Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. Five prime ministers under these Tories. It is embarrassing. It is an embarrassment for Labour, and that's why he's angry at Labour and not at Theresa May here.
Done the Telegraph, the Express, who provided the ramp for pro-Brexit propaganda pre the campaign and post the campaign. Just booming all Brexit, you know, but yeah, Brexit is good. It's brilliant. It's going to make the country great, and no other news that might collide with that is ever. So she's under pressure from that and from the right wing of the Tory party, who say to her, look, if you reopen this, we're going to split the Tory party again.
Do you think this, if hard Brexit does go ahead, do you think it's likely that Scotland will become independent?
I don't know. I think it's very hard to judge. But I think the fact that Brexit clearly imposes a big strain on the Union, both in respect to Scotland and actually in respect to Northern Ireland, means that it imposes an even greater obligation on us only to do this if the gain is substantial and the pain is not. Right. Is not. And the fact is, it's the other way around. So, you know,
on Northern Ireland, I mean, I don't know about you, but I just find the extent to which Northern Ireland, I know you and Major went there, but the extent to which it barely figured during the campaign or since, at a time when in Ireland they are seriously, seriously worried about the impact, is just shows we're in a kind of la-la land.
Well, the trouble with Northern Ireland is that, you know, our generation remembers the peace process in Northern Ireland and knows how terrible it was and
what a
deep mark it left on British politics. But today's generation of people, I mean, it's not been an issue for 20 years. Yeah.
She went to Northern Ireland and left the distinct impression she hadn't even given it much thought.
Well, I don't know whether she did that or not, but the fact is, it's a very difficult thing to work out how you have a hard border with the EU, which is now going to be the border in Northern Ireland. Mm. And remember, you know, when we're talking about trade, we have more trade with Ireland than we do with India or...
Barmy, all these Barmy. You know, some... Cameron should never have had the referendum.
Look, in the course of the last election campaign, and this is what shows you how strange the situation is we're in. I mean, I think I was the only person who made a speech on Europe in the course of the 2015 election campaign, precisely to warn that the referendum was not a good idea. Mm. But, you know, look, I understand why he he felt he had to do that. Mm. And, you know, to be fair to him, he campaigned very hard in the referendum for the right result. So,
Do you ever dream about Gordon?
Oh, for God's sake, Alistair, get off the damn dreaming
Gordon?
Thing.
Do you ever dream about Gordon?
No, I'm not.
That's a lie. You must dream about
Look,
Gordon.
You obviously have a problem with your dreams. No, so go and go. I'm not your shrink.
Okay. So you've never dreamt about Gordon. I know you've dreamt about Gordon because you've told me about dreams about Gordon.
I
think some of them are in the diaries, volume 7. When was the last time you spoke to Gordon?
A short time ago, actually.
Re?
What were you doing? But you I think just re- Scotland, you, British politics.
You just bump into him at
establishment. Yeah, and we see each other.
When was the last time you spoke to Corbyn?
I don't know. That's some time ago, I guess.
Has he ever phoned you up and said, Tony, you just used to do this job, got any tips?
No, but, you know, why should he?
Well, because you've done the job.
Yeah, but you know, we obviously disagree strongly about the direction of the Labour Party.
Do you think there's any chance ever that Jeremy Corbyn would be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom?
I think we've got to pass on that one.
It's not a no.
No, it's not a no. It's look, I don't. Look, how do I answer this without just getting into a whole heap of Blair attacks Corbyn? I mean, look,
you
I don't
know.
There
was a survey yesterday that 2% of people think that Blair is not a Blairite. That was good. but there is a...
Look, it's no great secret that I obviously think the Labour Party's gone in profoundly the wrong direction since I left in 2007.
Right, but at the moment, the way that the people talk is that I keep hearing, oh, well, we're just going to have to lose an election and then rebuild. But we might lose an election and get wiped out.
Oh, no, it's a big mistake to think that, yes.
So we could get, we could be seeing the end of the Labour Party.
Well,
as a serious credible political force.
I don't know, but what I am very, very clear about is two things. Number one, if people think you can just go into the next election, lose it heavily and come out and rebuild... there may be no bottom to this market, so this is a very, very dangerous course indeed. Yeah. And secondly, because of Brexit, it's a betrayal of our duty to the country if we're not offering a competitive opposition. I mean, we've got to do that. So, look, I don't. My desire is for the Labour Party to recover itself.
But by the way, throughout this interview, he wouldn't attack Trump, he wouldn't attack Putin, he wouldn't attack Theresa May. But when it comes to Corbyn, like, yeah, fucking two-footed, let's have it, you know. Really quite amazing.
I mean, I'm not going to get into attacking Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labour Party. I mean, you know, people understand whether I think this was a good idea or not. I said before the leadership election, I thought it wasn't, but I don't want to start attacking him because actually I think this has gone beyond being about him. Mm. This is about a direction of the Labour Party. If the Labour Party is going to win power again, it's got to own the future.
Right. Do you think...
It's always won.
Okay,
but
right. Politics is a continuum. I did a piece for GQ a few weeks ago about Corbyn, and I said, there is part of it that thinks, well, Tony, begat Gordon, begat Ed, begat Jeremy. Do you think there's something in that? Do you think we sort of started this?
No, because I think we were always very clear about our own position.
But we paved the way for Gordon, who changed a bit, and then Ed came in, who changed a bit more.
But Gordon was in a supremely strong position to become the leader of the Labour Party. So, I think rather than go back over the personalities of it, there's a much, much bigger question, which is about the future of progressive politics.
Right.
And I think the progressive political position only wins when it builds out from the centre, mm-hmm. and when it has policies designed for the future.
But that's being rejected.
And it has been rejected in the Labour Party, and we can see the result. We lost in 2010. We lost even bigger in 2015. And now we're 15 points adrift in the middle of a Tory government, losing safe Labour seats to the Tories. So,
and then they lost an 80-seat majority in the next election. So Blair was right. Absolutely 100% he is correct about this.
You know, the one thing I find really weird about the present situation is when people who are presently running things ascribe their defeats to those of us who won victories. I mean, but all I can say to people in the Labour Party is, if you want to get back...
You're losers, I'm a winner, basically, is what he said. Stop blaming your losses on me, because I won three times in a row. Bigger, and his majorities were bigger than 80, by the way. So,
into a position of being a competitive opposition with a chance of winning power, you've got to go back to the centre, definitively and clearly, and you've got to have policies that address the future. And this is the, you know, it's
You're not arguing for...
And do you remember what I showed you at the start? The Starmer, you know, Labour is going to become more conservative now and all that sort of stuff. That is exactly the Blair plan. Definitively back from the centre, right? And, I mean, that's why the Starmer headlines are so kind of extreme as they are, because remember, they're correcting for how far left the party drifted under Corbyn. And I'm not just talking about Corbyn socialism. I'm talking about the woke politics and the fucking Diane Abbotts and the, you know, all the nonsense that we've seen, the Owen Joneses and the Ash Sarkars and so on. But Blair knows that these sorts of figures aren't popular. It's electoral suicide. He knows that. So they need to make a big fist of, you know, in a way, like being more base than the Tories. That's their play, which is not that difficult because, you know, the Tory party is one of the gayest parties of all time at this point.
Return to New Labour.
New Labour, you've got to demystify New Labour. All New Labour was...
Do you not think the centre is being rejected?
No, I don't think the centre is rejected by the people.
Right.
I mean, I think, it's look, in 2015, Cameron won from essentially a centre-right position.
Hmm.
Cameron was me!
You know, if you look...
So what do you say? You keep saying this thing about...
I mean, he's incredulous then, because he's like, listen, Cameron was me, damn it. When Cameron won, that was me winning.
Right, if we go into the next election with a hard Brexit Tory, I think actually quite hard, UKIP, Tory leader, and a hard left leader, you've got millions of people who are politically homeless. Surely the logical conclusion of that is that what's happening, the churn in politics at the moment, can only be broken now by some sort of new political force emerging. Or is that
or
too
the
difficult
old
because of our system?
I think it's extremely difficult. Or the old political forces reasserting their
But that's just not happening inside the Labour Party at the moment.
No, it's not. But
and we,
But it should, and I will make it happen. And which is exactly what he's done.
And people like you and me are sort of opting out of that and devoting our energies to Brexit because we feel at least that's maybe got a chance.
Also because it's the most urgent thing facing the country. And one of the things that the Labour Party's got to understand about the present situation is that when you've got something as critical as Brexit happening, the country and millions of people out there are expecting us to lead.
So could there not? Could there be a place for a? I mean, the Lib Dems, I know, have got a very clear position. The SNP have got a clear position. Could there be a case for a new pro-European party that fights the next election just on that? The next election, not the one after. The next election.
No, I think it's incredibly difficult to start something new.
But then we're
in British politics.
Then we're doomed.
I still think and
hope we're doomed on Brexit, and we're doomed. Labour Party's dead.
We're doomed. He's he's dad's army posting.
No, I don't. I've never. We're all doomed.
We're quite doomed. Feels quite doomed.
It's challenging. Yeah, it's challenging. I think you can build a movement in the country that holds the government to account
on Brexit. Right. Okay. Do you feel you have more in common with Jeremy Corbyn or Nick Clegg?
not getting into those questions because they're too difficult.
Do you think you're more
for me to answer without getting into a situation where I mean.
But Clegg, it's Clegg. Have you seen Clegg? Does Clegg ever phone you up and say, let's have a chat about this, that, and the other? In a way that Jeremy doesn't?
No, I discuss Europe with him from time to time, and I admire what he's doing on Europe.
Do you have more in common with Tim Farron than Clegg? Than Corbyn?
Now, I'm not getting into all the personality.
More common with Sturgeon? What do you think of Nicola?
I think she's a very effective politician.
What do you think about her basic argument that Brexit has totally, fundamentally changed the debate on Scotland and Scotland now should have another vote?
Look, I think it is a change, and I don't think you can... You know, people in the Labour Party were angry with me when I have said it's a...
You see, I do think with his badgering and his kind of interview style here, Campbell has got something else out of Blair that we don't usually see. Because what usually happens in these interviews is that you just get his initial slick answer and nothing else, basically. Whereas, you know, Campbell has kind of drawn out Blair throughout this interview. And like, you know, even with that, with the way he approached that question, you know, we got to know that he phones Nick Clegg. He's closer to Clegg than he is to Corbyn, right? I mean, if it wasn't already obvious, but he's just kind of confirmed it.
Material change in the situation. But as I said to them, look, I can hardly go through the referendum campaign saying, if you vote Brexit, it's going to be a problem for the union, and then afterwards say, no, it's really not a problem at all. Mm. I mean, we should leave that to the Leave campaigners. But but having said that, I do not think independence is sensible for Scotland, even if Brexit happens. And
but
I do not think there's a case for another referendum.
If you were Scottish, well, you kind of are, you were born in Scotland, if you were Scottish and you saw a way of Scotland independent, I know it's difficult, staying as a member of the European Union, and rather than being part of this exited, Brexited UK, is that not a very, very attractive option if you're Scottish?
I still think...
Even with all the obstacles?
No, I still think it's better for Scotland to remain part of Britain.
Even out of Europe? Which you think is going to be a catastrophe?
Yeah, because I think in the end, the union between England and Scotland is so important. But having said that, today, with Britain in Europe, you can be Scottish, British and European.
Exactly.
After Brexit, you can be two of those things, but not all three of them.
Yeah.
So that's the tragedy of it.
Paul Dacre, force for good or bad in the world?
And I think what that the politics that he drives through the Daily Mail is very damaging for Britain.
Rupert Murdoch, force for good or force for bad?
So I disagree with him on politics too.
Murdoch?
Yeah.
So did we get too close to Murdoch?
Well, you know why we did get close. We got close because we'd been absolutely savaged by the media throughout the 80s and the early 90s.
But we kept it on for quite a long time. Only really fell out of Murdoch when he started, you know, getting...
Yeah, but it's
Wendy.
It's a different...
Ooh, I mean, that was a bit cheeky of Campbell there. This is a little bit of Blair deep lore that you might not know. Do you remember Rupert Murdoch had that wife called Wendy? I think she was just like she's Chinese or Japanese. Anyway, Wendy, who was Murdoch's wife for a while, had an affair with Blair. And in fact, if you search for that, there are newspaper articles where they're quoting from Wendy Murdoch's diary about her encounters with Blair. That is why Rupert Murdoch and Blair fell out, basically. It was because of that.
Look. I mean,
Wendy,
I'm
the worst
person
of those two.
No,
Dacre and Murdoch.
I'm
not getting that. Dacre and Murdoch.
What? I am... I have changed my view about the media because of
you come to my
Brexit.
View.
No one could ever be quite as...
So let's just admit it.
Jihadist on the subject.
Mail
as,
watch.
As, oh, please.
Mail,
no,
watch.
Mail watch.
Admit you made a mistake.
No.
You did. You stopped me
doing
we were
the government,
daily
Alistair.
Rebuttal.
We were the government.
Right. But
anyway, let me,
the government.
Let me make my point about the media.
Right. Make your point.
Okay. Which is that I think their activities in Brexit changed the dynamic of their relationship to politics. Hang on.
They've been doing it for years.
No, they have. But this is a decision that changed the whole course of our country's history.
But it only happened because of the way they cover politics up to the for a decade or more.
Are you going to allow me to finish what I'm saying? So
he was probably pissed off then.
You know, whatever issues I have with the media and the way that increasingly over time newspapers have become the playthings of a small group of very powerful individuals, my view is they crossed the line when they operated like a cartel in respect to Brexit.
But we allowed them to.
No, hang on a minute. We didn't allow them to do this, where they were coordinating and boosting.
But we gave them
boosting
the space and the oxygen and the power that got them that access,
yeah,
that influence on our debate.
Okay, you can debate about the history. I'm debating about what it is now. Right. And what I'm saying is that I think they crossed the line at that point for me. And, you know, to have this small group of individuals who control the press, who, on the right, who provided that ramp for the propaganda and who provide the vilification of anybody who dares oppose that now, when it's not a decision of these newspapers, like as if they're institutions. This is a decision of individuals, right? These individuals control these papers. They wouldn't be taking these decisions, these papers, unless they were instructed to do so. And I think that is, that's a line that they've stepped over.
Right, and nothing's
and therefore,
happening about it.
Whereas I, you know, for ages and ages and ages have not sort of criticised them openly. I'm sorry, this is not on. You have put yourself in a different position in relation to the democracy of the country. Mm. You know, especially given many of them don't actually live and pay taxes in this country. And I think that is going to be an issue.
So I was right, Tony. What did you tell you? What was when I tried to get you to do this 10 years ago, I was right. But you didn't do it because you were too close to them. We were too close to them.
That wasn't the reason. It's also because... Oh, look, I'll be frank with you. It's partly because, you know...
It's easier in power to keep them on board.
No, it's also because when you go and fight them, when you're in my position, not in your position, it's a full-on fight because these people have come after you with everything they've got. Mm. I mean, they're like a mafia.
Do you have anything else you'd like to apologise to me or the nation for? Ruining my life? Any of that sort of thing? No?
So there we are. That was good. That was probably the best one we've... probably the best one that we've covered, I think. Well, best one I've seen, certainly. All right, let's just do some super chats and we'll get out of here. I'll have a look at the entropy. It's just reloading a minute. Maybe there are no entropies. That's rare. But if there are entropies, I'm not seeing them. So I'll have a look at the other super chats. I don't think they were there. Nope. So let's have a look in main super chats. And we've got a few here. Nathan CJ Hood said, if you ever met Blair, what would you say to him? I don't know what I'd say. I mean, it's probably best not to meet heroes, is what they say. So I probably won't meet Blair. Mackie in Chain says, I have two free non-Longhouse days off soon. Can I reasonably do a Foundations of Writing or similar course in 2 days? Yes, you can. Yes, Mackie in Chains. Foundations of Writing, you easily do it. You'd probably do it in 1 day if you really set your mind to it. O2 Tom says, Labour MPs all have pronouns in their bio. Concerning. I mean, if they're really going to do this, they have to do it properly, and Starmer needs to, like, stop all of that. My concern is that they're not really moving fast enough. And that there's a lot of rot in the party. So I'm starting to think that he may be Kinnock as opposed to Blair. you know, it might take longer, which would mean yet another Tory election win. I mean, maybe they have to just ramp it up super, super quick because the Tories are just so rubbish now. Dyslexic Generator says, watch the 4 season of Succession, pretty please. What is 4 season of Succession? What is that? William Hero says, I think the push on Iraq is to solidify the narrative that that his only problem is foreign policy, and that if he'd focus on domestic politics, he'd be perfect. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I do think Campbell probably was thinking, like, you know, I want a lot of people to watch this. And I mean, I don't know if there were headlines generated by this, but it would be like, you know, Campbell confronts Iraq with Blair or something like that. No, because they have to, and a lot of people did watch that interview at the time, so clearly they did something right. Spot the Spy says Campbell is insufferable. That's all. Yeah, I mean, he's usually less kind of SJW-ish than that, because I listen to his podcast sometimes, and he's usually not as bad as that. So I don't know if he was playing it up just to get a kind of better interview out of Blair, or, you know, because they were actually trying to make Blair look good or what. But, you know, I think his Trump derangement syndrome is what it was, genuine, though. I seem to remember Campbell on TV being like that as well. The Enriab says, Blair is a high-functioning sociopath. He operates on 2 levels and hides his agenda behind palatable language. An evil genius, the voice of Saruman. Ben Davis has just given me £1.99. I think that is it for the Super Chats, unless I'm very much mistaken. I'm not seeing anything in Entropy. If you did leave a Super Chat in Entropy, I apologize that I'm not seeing it. Let me just double check. I've got another way of looking at these. No, I don't think there have been any. And that's it. Fantastic. All right. Well, I'll be back tomorrow night for Unpopular Opinions. Just a reminder, you've still got opportunity to buy courses at Academic Agency. Most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out. Where is it?
Drainage healer.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.